Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. In 1856, the East India Company imposed the Hindu Widow Remarriage Act, allowing widows to remarry after their husband's death. The act was controversial at the time. Hindu traditionalists, particularly in higher castes, prevented widows from remarrying to protect the family's honor, and even teenage and child widows were expected to live lives of austerity. The following year, the Marathi author Baba Padmaji publishes Yamuna's Journey, one of the first, if not the first, novel in an Indian language. The novel, recently translated by Deepa Dandekar, follows the story of Yamuna, an educated Marathi woman and secret Christian, and her husband Vinayak as they travel the region, encountering tragic tales of Hindu widows prevented from remarrying. Deepa Dandekar is a researcher at the Leibniz-Zentrum Moderner Orient in Berlin. She is the author of Baba Padmaji, Vernacular Christianity in Colonial India, the first critical biography of Baba Padmaji in English. We're joined today by Mariam Haider. Mariam, would you like to say a few words about yourself?
Thanks, Nicholas. Hey, everyone. I'm Mariam Haider, an independent writer, researcher, and podcast producer based in Singapore.
Today, the three of us will talk about Yamuna's Journey, its Christian roots, and the debate about widow remarriage in 19th century India. So, Deepa, I mean, to start with that, Yamuna's Journey has such a strong social message. It's pretty clear the author's point of view is. And it refers to tensions between, say, British ideas and Indian ideas about widow remarriage, or just about, like, ethics and traditions in general. Could you, maybe to start, give us a brief snapshot of what India is like when this novel is being written?
Thanks for the question. I think this is an important part of the novel, because this was the period which was about 20 or 30 years after the Peshwas were defeated by the British after the Anglo-Maratha War. And this was a big deal for the fact that the Brahmin Peshwas had put together a sort of caste-based court. I mean, it's not a it was not a coincidence that most people who held powerful positions in the Peshwa court were Chitpavan Brahmins. And this was a time where there was, with this defeat came a huge amount of resentment. And this resentment was in the Bombay area, of course, Brahminical. So in terms of a backdrop, one already sees a huge merge between Brahminism and nationalism in the Bombay presidency. And that was directly predicated on the fact that it was the Maratha Empire and the Peshwas who were defeated in the battle. So in terms of a brief snapshot, this Brahminical nationalist resentment was actually the context in which Padmanji first gained his education in a missionary organization. And when predictably his enemies and his opposers remained the supporters of the Peshwai, the Brahminical variety of nationalists, nascent nationalists, who were then in the presidency.
I think that's very interesting that you talk about the sort of the Anglo-Maratha War, and then you take us into this book. Because when I was reading, one of the first things that came to my mind was also the idea of how there were other reformist movements happening within not the same place, but in different parts of what was then British India. And I want to kind of, you know, ask from you, what were the influences that Baba Padmanji would have had of those, you know, movements of sorts, and also the own feminist sort of understanding? Because the book is very feminist, especially written at a time when it was written in the first place.
I think reform as an idea in the Bombay presidency was in that time very deeply connected to missionary education, and many people who held reformist views, especially in groups such as the Paramhans Mandali that was started in Bombay in 1850 or 51. These were all students of the Wilson School, of the Robert Monet School, of the kind of first large British educational institutions that took root after the Second Charter Act. So these ideas about reform and ideas of conversion went hand in hand at that time. One could not separate ideas about widowry marriage or sati or so many of these so-called social evils from missionary education, early missionary education at that time. So they went, they were quite together. The Paramhans Mandali was, of course, it was a reform organization, very strongly. And they were against caste strictures and so on. And one of the initiation rituals of entering the Mandali was that one had to buy bread from a Portuguese bakery and share it amongst everybody and eat the bread. Now, the taboo about something like that, the caste taboos of about something like that was tremendously high. And Padmanji writes a lot about how he felt when he ate that bread with the others for the first time. He felt as if everybody on the road outside when he was walking there knew that he had broken his caste. And he felt very exposed, and it shattered him in a way, at least temporarily speaking, before he converted. So reform is not something. Now, the Paramhans Mandali broke up soon thereafter. I mean, it was not a very long-standing organization. As the parents of the younger boys who had started it got to know that they were breaking caste there, and they sort of got them to shut it all down. But the members of the Paramhans Mandali regrouped as the Prarthana Samaj later on in Bombay in the 1860s, end of the 1860s. They were the same people. Atmaram, Pandurang, all these people were the same. I think it was missionary education that was the influence over both Christian reform as well as Hindu reform, right? As well as feminism or ideas that were in Yamuna Pariyatan, they were informed and rooted within missionary education. They were rooted within the early ideas also that came from Bengal, from the Scottish mission. Padmanji was part of the Scottish mission, no, Bombay Scottish. And the earlier ideas that came from the Calcutta Scottish, Alexander Dove. Then you had Krishna Mohan Banerjee. You had so many of these people who were talking about kulinism, problems with women's education, and so. Padmanji was very much influenced by the kind of convert reform politics that was taking place at that time, that was very enmeshed with Hindu reform. So the other thing that is part of his feminist ideas, or feminism actually didn't enter the lexicon till 1880s or something. And his ideas, which were, of course, in the 1850s, beginning of 1850s or so, were more rooted in his own experiences of marriage. So his wife divorced him. In 1857 itself, he lost the habeas corpus, as his wife declared in court that she did not want to return to him because he had converted to Christianity. And a lot of his ideas were therefore rooted in the desire that he had for a companionship with the ideal woman, the ideal modern woman who was a proto-convert, who held in her heart that she had given her heart to Jesus and would convert eventually at a certain point of time in her life. And that was something that was already very clear.
Since we are talking of what you just mentioned in terms of, you know, Padmanji's, you know, his relationship with his first wife, do you think, you know, Vinayak and Yamuna's marriage was like an aspirational marriage that he wanted to bring into the literature?
Well, totally. I don't think there were any marriages like that at the time, I think. I can't imagine. And this was a very intimate kind of, some of the intimacy, of course, sounds more normal normal in English, because you are more used to talking in the language of love when you talk about married couples, or partners, or whatever. But it already sounds awkward in Marathi, but it's he really wanted something like that. He really wanted to have a wife with whom he could share a relationship like the one that Vinayak and Yamuna had, I think.
Yeah. So maybe you can share with us a bit of the story for our listeners as well to understand, you know, how Yamuna and Vinayak's story sort of takes us on a journey itself of understanding the tensions that were prevalent then, especially when it came to widowed marriages, and it just gives us a better understanding of the follow-up questions as well.
Yeah. So, for example, but I think one of the main things that Padmanji asserted at the time was that Yamuna Pariyatan was based on true events. And these true events were either anecdotes that he had collected by himself traveling to various areas, which of course in the story was done by Yamuna and Vinayak. So it's actually fictionalized, and all these sort of anecdotes that Padmanji collected personally or through letters that were sent to him by his associates who were going into society and doing fieldwork and finding out information and so on. So instead of actually stating this as information, what he did was that he wove all these anecdotes within the storyline. The storyline is pretty simple. Yamuna and Vinayak are married, and Yamuna and Vinayak are both educated within missionary institutions, and they both have the secret feeling for Christianity, and Yamuna more so than Vinayak. And so they travel due to Vinayak's business meetings and business deals throughout Maharashtra, which is of course the whole double meaning of the word Yamuna Pariyatan. Pariyatan meaning travel and tourism, and not tourism in those days, but yeah, travel or making a round of these areas. And of course, this also is the kind of takeoff on the title itself, because Yamuna Pariyatan is also the widow's pilgrimage, right? So he uses it in this double way. And so they go off to various cities and they meet fictional characters who tell them all the information about the state that widows are living in, the state that, the way in which widows are tortured. These are anecdotes which are built into conversations that they meet, that they have with fictional characters when they meet them in the story. So basically, Yamuna and Vinayak go from place to place meeting widows, and the stories are then contained therein as recounted to them by those widows. And then they meet one specific widow. The whole focus of the story is that the specific widow whom they meet in a pilgrimage town. Pandharpur is a very important pilgrimage town for Vithoba and the Lord Vithoba. And there he encounters a widow, and they rescue her because she's, of course, because she has no support system, she's, of course, working as a prostitute. And her son, Shivram, is also growing up like an orphan because he has no education, he has no care, and so on. So it's, of course, the whole conversation is extremely moralistic, but there is a voice to that widow and the way in which she's undergoing suffering, how she was kidnapped and how she was forced into sex work and so on. And then she's rescued, and on their way back, Vinayak has a huge political discussion with his earlier classmate, in which most of the discussions that were prevalent at the time within a certain section of upper caste educated men were articulated. Anwar articulated in a way, giving Padmanji credit, who could write, of course, very harshly when he wanted to. He has represented them fairly, without sounding very derisive or very sarcastic about. He did all those other. He did this thing very. He did this very often. The sarcasm, it was horrible in some of the ways he talked about his enemies or his detractors. But he didn't do so in this. Do it in this way in the novel, and he's represented them. And then, of course, he dies. And before he dies, he, of course, secretly converts to Christianity. And, I mean, on his deathbed. And so Padmanji, I guess, thinks that Vinayak's soul has been redeemed. And then Yamuna is ill-treated by her mother-in-law and almost forced into going through all the sort of tonsure rituals that Padmanji presents as a subversive kind of continuation of the sati ritual. And because she has to be taken to the cremation ground and her hair has to be shorn off and has to be cremated along with the ritualized effigy of the husband's body. And that ritual that takes place in the cremation ground, through which she also does her own death rituals, he presents it in a way, although he doesn't say it explicitly, he presents it in the way that to show that the sati ritual continued in this subversive kind of form, after which the widow was therefore automatically somebody who was not only a social persona anymore, but she was also somebody who had to live almost like a corpse herself, starving herself, living in the most austere of conditions, had to labor in the household, was often at the receiving end of physical and sexual violence. She was a non-person. So this he brought this up very evocatively, that a widow did not live. She had to live in a way that was a death-like experience for her, because the widowhood ritual was already a ritual that killed her. So the ritual was real, for people, they believed in it. So it killed her.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So in that sense, I have read through Yamuna Pariyatan many times, and I'm still undecided. Of course, there is the moral outrage about prostitution that he had. But at the same time, I do see that he was able to speak about these women in a way that showed that they were trying to live. They were trying to live a life where they could earn, they could feed their dependents like children, or they could survive somehow. So I'm mixed about that. And I guess Padmanji was himself a bit mixed about that. I'm not sure what he himself thought. So coming to one of the questions that is about what is this kind of in-betweenness, right? And this in-betweenness to writing of real-time anecdotes that have been collected from the field and trying to make them empathetic quickly experienced and understood. Sort of fictional, a very basic kind of fictional narrative was evolved around these anecdotes. And I think that this was a way he wanted to reach out about the various critical points, like his criticism of pilgrimage places and the hell holes that there were, and the points, like the areas of corruption that they constituted. And so he got a lot of his points through, but instead of saying them, articulating them as political points, he exemplified it through. And I think this is also part, this kind of exemplification is also part of the kind of genre. I've elsewhere called it a Christian vernacular genre. And I think that I had no other way but to talk of it in terms of a genre, because I was unable to think of how one could articulate something that mixed the different kinds of existent sort of, I'm not sure whether even existent genres, but the different kind of known, so charitra, you know, biography, or didactics, upadesha, and or sermons, and all this has been merged, this didacticism plus biography plus Christian homilies, parable-like examples from daily life, and song and poems and devotionality, and all this has been merged together to kind of form this message, which is in between genres. It's in between, it's a parable kind of writing. So it merges the so many different kinds of ways of communicating.
Thank you for actually, just illuminating us on that note, because this is something which you otherwise don't come across. We always read reformist movement, especially in the Indian school and educational system, where we have very few names and we just kind of see everything through their lens. I have one final question for you, since we are talking about Padmanji's women characters. There is one particular character of a widow that I was very inclined to know, kind of understand from her story more about. She is someone who's asking for alms, and then the cook offers to give her a piece of wood, but she refuses to take it from him because he's one of the oppressed castes, right? And then the widow explains how she is not in favor of widow remarriage, how she is not comfortable with the idea of this entire reformist movement that was happening. Can you please explain more on that? Because I was really intrigued by that character.
Yeah, I think Padmanji also Padmanji also wrote about the Brahmin widow, chapter 10, in a certain way. No? See, the whole missionary idea, it's also a general political idea in the post-colonial period, that political lobbying is connected around interests. You know? So the whole idea that Ambedkar, interest, for our own caste, women, interest for our own group, that women's emancipation, this whole idea of this is going to benefit us. And so we need to be politically invested and motivated in the movement. Padmanji's ideas of conversion were avant-garde exactly because they were similar. This is something that literary critic Bhalchandra Nemade also pointed out. This is one of the earliest examples of this kind of political activism of what's going to be good for your soul, what's going to be good for your life. If that's going to be good for you, then you should imbibe it, right? Now, these are early ideas about politics of interest and not politics of, let's say, abstract values. These are very much to do with the lives of people who are being downtrodden, whether they be of a different caste or background or women and so on. And Padmanji is self-reflexive enough, though he shows her as somebody who's a kind of a paradoxical figure, but that's his representation of her. This is also about the fact that he was talking for the first time about the politics of conversion, the politics of interest. That if you are being ill-treated by all the men of your family, then why don't you just chuck it over and marry someone else and, in brackets, convert to Christianity? It is something that will enable you. It's something that's in your interest. Now, I think this was very early for the first kind of conversations about the politics of interest that we see emerging in Maharashtra, at least only with Jyotiba Phule later on in a more concentrated kind of way. Otherwise, you do not hear of the politics of interest. There was no social movement that made this about us and our interest, and so we should take this over. And I think this is part, this early conversation, this early fledgling efforts at trying to say that this is good for us. And I think this runs through the entire relationship of Vinayak and Yamuna as well, because there are chapters that talk about the picnics they are having, and they are going to some rural homestead and doing, they love to play, and such beautiful descriptions, and oh, we are having such wonderful food and so on and so forth. And we are having a little party. We are going in our little bullock cart and we are looking at sunrises and we are having... So he's already talking about interest, and not just spiritual interests, but conjugal interests, material interests, interests about becoming socially more powerful, socially more emancipated. He's talking about, though he couches it in the language of spirituality and meeting God and so on and so forth, but it's not just that. It's not as innocent as that. So this is also the politics of how there are people who are not interested in this kind of material change. They are more interested in having a caste-based society that was part of the Peshwai period. So the same widow, right? She is saying, yeah, there's so much of... licentiousness in society, and all these widows are so licentious and they are so bad, and it's because of them that we get a bad name, and so on and so forth. That she says, yeah, but if this was the Peshwai, they would have punished these women, and they should still have had sati, so that then all these women who are now doing these licentious activities would have gone to meet their husbands in death. And it's because of, she calls them the company, you know, the company, I think. She says that the company is ruled by a woman in England, and that is why this is all has happened. So there is, you do see that Padmanji recognizes the presence of women who did support the same Brahminical patriarchy that men were supporting. But this was not completely through just the politics of interest, but it was also through the politics of certain values, abstract values, to do with purity and to do with chasteness and to do with all those ideas. I think the sort of politics of interest that came in, we are already talking about colonialism, we are already talking about nationalism, the interests of groups, reforms, and so on. It came a little bit later.
I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, so I want to, I think, kind of end our conversation by going maybe big picture again. You know, what do you think the place or what place does this book, does Yamuna's Journey hold when we talk about the history of Indian literature? Kind of where, if you had to kind of like construct a story of the development of Indian literature, where does Yamuna's Journey fit in that story?
I'm not certain whether I'm very knowledgeable about Indian literature in general, because there's just so much there, which of course, which I haven't read, as I haven't been able to read all that. But I can say a little bit about the whole way of writing realistically. So we have a literary historian and critic, no, Balchandra Nemade, who has talked about Yamuna Pariyatan as one of the earliest examples of realistic novels. You know, earlier the idea of a novel was poetic, not completely kavya or poetics completely, but very much within a kind of fictionalized writing style that mixed miracles and mixed celestial beings and into the normal course of events, and a very Puranic kind of writing style with stories. And for the first time, you had Padmanji coming in with something that was realistic, which was about the society that we lived in, its material problems, its social problems, the problems of women, and especially dealing for the first time with the sexuality and those frustrations of widows who were just completely alone in their lives. And I think so. It has been so. Yamuna Pariyatan today happily is one of the novels that is taught in the master's courses of Marathi literature in Maharashtra. So it is one of those earliest examples of social literature, which in the post-colonial period, of course, took on in a major way. You had people writing about different kinds of social problems, caste and this and that. So people talk about personal experiences, and this was not there at the time that Padmanji was writing. So I think one of the main contributions is the fact it's so early, it's so bold, it's so hard-hitting, it's based on realism. He said again and again, these are all real anecdotes. I've collected them. I've just woven it within the story. So I think that was one of the big contributions. The second, sorry, am I interrupting you?
No, please. What was the second big contribution?
Yeah. So the second thing is, I feel that Marathi literature, vernacular literature, is still in the stages of discovery. So as far as translations and so on are concerned, I mean, Yamuna Pariyatan had to wait till 2022, right? Before it came out into the market. Similarly, there was a novel called Smriti Chitre, a very influential memoir. It was written by a lady again called Lakshmi Bai in the 1930s. She was the wife of a very illustrious Brahmin Christian missionary called Narayan Vaman Tilak. And it had to wait till 2017 to be first translated into English by Sharada Gokhale. So there is still the process of rediscovery in translation, and this is still continuing. And it's still pretty new. And I think the bias is really high against Christian literature because it has a clearly missionizing nature, because it was written in a certain period of time where missionizing was an important goal. So it has a missionizing nature, and this is something that is politically problematic today because missionizing texts are deemed a bit dangerous. So so the discovery and translation of Hindu reform texts have been comparatively speedier. You have far much more of exposure to Jyotiba Phule's Tritiya Ratna and the other things that social reformers wrote at that time in comparison to Christian literature, which was about converts and convert biographies, and to talk about the kind of social background and political context of conversion. So I think Christian literature, vernacular literature, is still at the cusp of it all, and especially Protestant literature, which is prose and which is very political in nature, very interest-oriented in nature. So this is still being actually just being done in comparison to works such as Phule or other freedom fighters of the time, later time, Agarkar, Gokhale, Radhade, Tilak, Savarkar, all these people who were on the later stage of events. They have been written about far more. They have been written about this sort of, there's much more on that. So I think this early literature where Marathi vernaculars really took off through missionary education, and there was this whole Macaulay's Minute, and there were these educational reforms, and Arabic, Persian, Sanskrit, these were all removed from the curriculum, and you had the emergence of the vernacular as the modern way of talking about life and religion and culture and conversion and print and so on. I think this immediate phase is not somehow received too much of importance, and I think there's a lot of space there to develop further.
Well, thank you for listening to our interview with Deepa Dandekar, translator of Yamuna's Journey. Deepa, we actually have two final questions for you, which are, where can people find your work, and what's next for you? What might the next project be?
So the book has been published, Yamuna Pariyatan has been published by Speaking Tiger. And the book on Padmanji that I wrote 2 years back, that is, of course, also made public through the India paperbacks version of Rutledge. So you have the UK version as well as the Indian paperback version of the same text. In terms of future, something that I'm working on finishing right now is a monograph on Sufi shrines in rural Maharashtra. So though there is a lot that is known on the shrines, khankas, dargahs of people who were connected with the court, who were connected with the Deccan Sultanate court, and then with the Mughals in Aurangabad and so on. There is quite a lot available in terms of sources on that. Now, what is not available, of course, is what happened to the thousands and thousands of rural dargahs. Every village in Maharashtra has one or two shrines. And who were they? We have no understanding of them. So what I have done is, last 10 years, I collected a lot of community publications, like dargah in the sort of committees bring out small little booklets that are about prayer, a little bit about the saints' hagiography, it is available, or the saints' miracles, the karamats that are there. So I have been collecting that now, like a community archives. I've been collecting that unending material now for a while. I've decided to now throw in the gauntlet and start writing. And I've combined these with oral narratives and interviews that I have had now, recorded now for many years, with people who have wanted to talk to me about their experiences with the shrine, what they understand the shrine. And this is, of course, integrated completely with their own life stories of receiving healing at the shrine. So I'm talking, I'm theorizing a little bit about what the Marathi shrine is and what the forgotten saint, the rural forgotten saint is, especially contextualized in post-colonial period where you had a demographic depletion of Muslims from the rural countryside that went more towards big cities or then to work with the girls outside or in any other country outside. So the whole formation of Maharashtra in 1960, the post-colonial sort of Hindu majoritarian sort of context, and what that did to these thousands and thousands of rural dargahs, where I haven't been to thousands, but I have been to as many which I could in order to get together a source, a sort of a decent source base, to be able to theorize what happened to them, what has happened to them. Or, I mean, contrary to what one thinks, they haven't been discarded or demolished. And contrary to what one may think, it isn't as if there is so much segregation that the Hindu devotee does not love the saint. There's enormous love for the saint. And how this kind of absorption into Hindu devotionality at a very local, rural base has transformed these dargahs into witchcraft healing functions and so on and so forth, not really into any kind of ideas of Hinduism as such. I mean, standardized Hindu texts or whatever, not that. So it's still ongoing. I'm still trying to get all my chapters together.
Well, hopefully we get to hear more about it. You can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at @NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at @BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network and newbooksnetwork.com. Mariam, where can people find you?
You can find me on Instagram at @MariamHaderHader19. Mariam Hader 19.
The NRB podcast, one of your podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Stay tuned for more news and who's coming up on the show. But before then, Deepra, thank you so much for joining us today.